The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Often it's hard to find content for the fourth pod of an international break, but some things have happened. Jose Mourinho is the new manager of Tottenham Hotspur. Not something I was expecting to say this season or ever, but there it is. Is he the right choice? Has he really changed his attitude to youth? Can this serial trophy winner do it at Spurs? And what about Pochettino? The right time to go? What is his legacy? We'll get into all of that before we congratulate the newest country to get to the Euros, Wales Golf Madrid. Aaron Ramsey's brace ensures qualification, and Gareth Bale doesn't care who knows it. It's the playoffs for the Republic, where they could meet Northern Ireland if they choose the right pathway. And if they navigate that, they'll get into the draw for the finals, which appears to have already been made. We'll do all that, look ahead to the return of the Premier League, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, Philippe Auclair, lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you. Barry Glendenning. I should be able to say your name.
Yes.
Really?
You got there in the end. Bonjour.
Barry Glendenning, good morning to you.
Bonjour.
George Ellick from Not the Top 20 podcast. Nice to see you, George.
Thank you.
How much of your time on social media is telling people you're not former Wolves hench centre-back George Ellacobi?
Whenever I come here, basically, whenever there's, you know, it's made known to a wide audience that I exist, people seem to look at my name, think I'm him, and sadly I'm not. But I had the pleasure of interviewing him a year or so ago. And can now call him my best friend, so that's nice, because he's a great man.
Yeah, he is a great man, isn't he? But you are also a great man.
Thanks very much.
That's
Thank
a
you.
Total
Thanks.
Pleasure. Well, let's start with Tottenham, shall we?
Talking about great men.
At 7:30 on Tuesday night, Spurs released a statement saying that Maurizio Pochettino had left the club. At 6:33 a.m. on Wednesday morning, they announced that Jose Mourinho was taking over. At Trevor Bastard said, quite amused by a big Premier League club hiring a new manager so toxic, they announced it at 6:33 in the morning. There's lots to get into. I think I'm still processing. I'm not as depressed as I was 24 hours ago. Philippe, what are your initial thoughts to that 12 hours in Tottenham Hotspur's history?
I'm like you, I'm still processing, and obviously I need to put a few more terabytes in this brain of mine to process it completely. I think I'm already written out. I think I've done four pieces about it yesterday.
Okay.
Trying to find a different angle each time. And amazingly enough, it was possible. Because where do you start? Do you start with how the story with Pochettino turned sour? Was it the right decision taken too late? Was it the wrong decision taken too early?
He had 5.5 years in charge, replaced Tim Sherwood in May of 2014. And look, Spurs established themselves as a top four team. In five full seasons, they finished fifth, third, second, third and fourth.
Yeah, I think if you look at who comes before a manager and then who comes after them, it's probably quite a good barometer of how they've done. And so when you've got Maurizio Pochettino sitting between Tim Sherwood and Jose Mourinho, I think that's quite significant. And it shows the way that the club has changed, their stature within the game has changed as well. And it's been a big bugbear of mine for a long time now, people who don't appreciate what he's done at the club by pointing to the fact he hasn't won a trophy. And of course, that is correct. But the achievements that he has undertaken at Spurs could far eclipse any League Cup win or any minor trophy like that. He took them to the Champions League final. He has built a squad full of homegrown players who have done very well internationally as well, and consistently got them playing within above their budget and their stature and into that top four. There's no question that the last year, because it's been nearly 12 months now where the performances have been fairly poor, there's no denying that whatsoever, but his impact on Tottenham Hotspur as a football club is very hard to overestimate, because he leaves them in a totally different position than they were in before.
Philippe, you said you've done four pieces already. The Guardian asked everybody who knows what football is to write a piece, so I got asked to do a piece. And I was thinking about Tottenham from a "they're my big team who win things" point of view. And Pochettino brought them these moments, you know, Amsterdam, the moment at the Etihad, the emergence of Dele Alli, that goal against Crystal Palace, you know, Harry Kane, numerous moments of Kane and Heung-min Son, the rebirth of Sissoko. He brought joy and hope to them, and those are quite important
and
things.
Not just to them, by the way. I think it changed completely the way we've been looking at Spurs. You know, he's turned them into something they were not before, that they might have been 40 years ago or 50 years ago, you know, in the good old days of UEFA Cup, you know, triumphs and so forth. He also completely, what he did is that the actual philosophy of the club, or what the fans would like to be the philosophy of the club in terms of the way they play, he brought it back to that club, but giving it a modern twist, a kind of Bielsa on turbocharged Bielsa kind of fashion. And for me, when you talk about the legacy, I cannot think, the way I think about this legacy, which is huge, as Josh was saying, is it's like if, well, he's built this wonderful thing. Now let's bring in somebody who's going to destroy it all. For me, it's an act of vandalism almost. It's more than a denial of what he's done. It's, it doesn't matter. We've got into our new stadium. We're in the Champions League. There's a chance we might make the top four again because we're not that far behind after all. So let's bring somebody who's going to do that. And to do that is going to set the house on fire. I mean, what on earth is going on here?
But that's exactly an issue with this appointment itself, is that the academy at Spurs are all drilled to play that certain way the whole way down. If you're an under-18s coach at Tottenham and you have a defensive style of football is your way you like to play, it doesn't matter. You are made to play the Pochettino style of football. And so you bring in a guy in Jose Mourinho who's not going to care what goes on beneath the first team, really. I mean, he points at Scott McTominay being an example of him, you know, investing in youth at Manchester United. I mean, that was the opposite. That was symbolic of a team that was not up to it. I mean, he may be a good player going forward in the future. There's no way McTominay should have been in that United team at the time that he was there. And so to take a club that's been built in the image of a man in Maurizio Pochettino and then bring in someone who's going to completely tear that up from the top all the way down to the bottom just seems absolutely crazy.
Yeah, I think Pochettino has been a victim of his own success. I personally, I think in the very first part of the season, I predicted he would not be at Spurs by the end of the season. And I think he should have left after the Champions League. But Tottenham now find themselves in a position where they've paid a load of money to get rid of one of the most sought after young managers and arguably most successful, despite the fact that he hasn't actually won anything, managers in world football, which just seems bizarre. And it's a legacy of their failure to freshen up their squad. I think the players were kind of sick of him and his methods and his double training sessions. And, you know, every manager, sort of with a couple of notable exceptions, has a pretty short shelf life. And I think he's ended in Madrid on the last game of last season. And they perhaps should have got rid of him then. But again, lovely bloke, great manager, has a huge future ahead of him, and they've replaced him with this jaded, cynical, unpleasant, argumentative, obnoxious, egomaniac bully.
You know, a few weeks ago, Barry, Spurs weren't doing great, and we were talking about, you know, would he go, and some people on social media saying Jose would be great. And I remember us laughing at the concept that you would put Jose Mourinho in charge of that football club.
I can't conceive. I've really been thinking about this. It actually kept me awake when it became apparent he was going to get the job. I was lying in bed trying to figure out what the thinking is behind it, because you've got him and you've got Levy, the chairman of Spurs, and I can't see how they can conceivably have a successful working relationship unless one of them radically changes the way they go about doing their job. And they're both middle-aged men, and middle-aged men aren't really renowned for radically changing the way they go about doing things.
Do you have any experience?
I have plenty of experience. So in that regard, I just cannot see how it would work. I mean, it's almost as if Daniel Levy didn't notice what was happening at Manchester United and Chelsea and Real Madrid during Jose's last three jobs. It's left me slightly baffled. I don't see the logic behind it, and it's almost certainly going to end in tears. But I suppose, depending on your measure of success, he may well win a cup with them, or, you know, a league cup. I'm not sure, which a lot of Spurs fans seem to, you know, we really want to win something, anything. But I wonder how many of those Spurs fans hark back to the glory days of the Juan de Ramos regime, you know, which is the last time they won a trophy.
Pochettino wasn't there as long as Wenger or Ferguson, and he didn't win anything. But are the conditions with him similar in a way, in that he sort of leaves Spurs, you know, he had a good bit and a not so good bit in a sort of more condensed time?
His not so good bit was still a Champions League final.
I know it sounds ridiculous to say it.
I know.
Yeah.
It is crazy. And the fact that I think that you will see him as being somebody who had a transformative effect on not just on the team but on the club. So it's just a question of seeing whether this transformative effect can be carried on through, you know, the tenure of Jose Mourinho. And people say he's changed and so forth. We'll probably come to that in a minute, because I don't think he's changed at all. But I don't know. I can say we're all speechless. We can't quite understand the logic behind that. And also the other thing is that this is not a move that was made in panic. You know, people have told about this is obviously something that's been in the pipeline for quite a long time. For example, to get Mourinho to prepare his dossiers and everything on the players, to make sure that financially everything was in place. So it's something which is part of, strangely enough, a strategy. But it's the strategy I can't quite understand. Because you were saying, I mean, you're quite right, Barry. I mean, the fact that he's a very demanding manager, and some players might, after a while, you know, running on empty, basically. But the fault is that it hasn't been refreshed. If he had had new players coming in, he would have been able to carry on doing this
with
refresh and get rid of the players who were a bit jaded and so forth. He hasn't been able to do that.
Does he leave Spurs with a bad squad, George?
No, I don't think so. I think there are certain areas where they need to improve. I mean, the fullback situation, how it's been able to get to where it is now, where they had very good attacking fullbacks who are so important to the way they play, and they just don't have that anymore and haven't replaced the players that are left. That's poor. But you have to look at, I mean, Harry Kane has not become, I know some people out there who maybe delve deeper into the numbers think that he has lost some of his power and some of his majesty, but I don't think that's necessarily true. I think there's still obviously a fantastic striker there, and his goal record recently has been back to how we expect it to be. And then players coming through as well. Harry Winks is a fantastic player in the middle of the park who you have to worry for under Jose Mourinho. You can't see how he's going to fit into his
So many people saying, you know, Alan, will England's new Pirlo Winks play for Spurs again? Tony Tett, are you excited by the Matic Dyer double pivot, etc.?
I mean, that's exactly right, and you have to be concerned. And we've seen today, you know, the back page of The Guardian today talks about Jose Mourinho knowing that he's going to have to work with the players that he's got at his disposal. And maybe that in itself will see a change in tack, because he won't be able to bring in the players that he was allowed to bring in. He won't have this bizarre power and control over transfers, which in this day and age you don't get anymore. You know, he was given basically a checkbook by Ed Woodward at Manchester United and could go out and get whoever he wanted.
Apparently he doesn't have money to spend in January.
Exactly, yeah.
What next for Poch, Barry?
Well, if I was Poch, I would take the rest of the season off, recharge, smell the roses, spend some time with my family, if he likes his family, assuming he does, and then wait and see what comes up in the summer, because I would imagine he will have no shortage of very high-profile, generous offers.
Marcus says, am I the only one who thinks Pochettino to Arsenal would be the kind of shithousery that even Spurs fans would admit that Daniel Levy deserves?
I would love it. And so would every Arsenal fan I've ever talked to since the announcement. I'm not sure that he's going to wait until the end of the season, because there are going to be quite a few jobs which are going to be made available pretty soon, I would imagine. There's one already which is available in Munich, because at the moment they still have an interim manager, and they were very interested in him in the spring.
Mm-hmm. Ten Hag is from Ajax.
That's also absolutely. But the fact that Pochettino is on the market will change a few things. Zidane is not exactly in the best of situations at Real Madrid. There are loads of people who are unhappy with PSG as Thomas Tuchel. And you have to remember that Mauricio Pochettino is a genuine PSG legend, as far as the fans are concerned. And then you look, and then of course there's Manchester United. So you think there are four jobs. I think one of them is already on the market. Three of them might be before the end of the season.
And look, he'll need to get back in soon, because he only got £12 million.
But I kind of think he looks like a guy who could do with a break.
Yeah.
And there's you know, he's the boss. He can dictate his own terms.
He could go to India with you.
Yeah, I'd love that. I would love that.
Baz and Mopo's Indian tour.
I'd watch it. There is an invitation there if you'd like to join me. I can't think of anything that would be more fun.
He's also got this big farm or ranch in Argentina. He's a farmer's son. He's a man, sort of the earth and man of the land. And where he has horses and all sorts of things. And he would love to spend... He actually used to go there as often as he could. And now he can spend some time with his caballos.
Now, listen, you all have touched on Jose Mourinho back in management after leaving Manchester United last December. James says, has Daniel Levy watched any football in the last 10 years? David Heitner writing, he's going to earn up to £13 million a year, which is significantly more than £8.5 million that Pochettino was getting. We've spoken on this pod before about whether football has passed him by. By all accounts, he has spent these last few months reflecting and asking people at Manchester United what they thought of how it was. He did this video where he said, there's not a manager in the world that doesn't like to play young players and help young players develop. I mean, I can think of one. and he's been told he's got no money to spend in January. Is this his last chance in the Premier League?
Probably. I mean, in the Premier League, maybe not. But at the Premier League's top table, you'd have to think so. It's interesting looking back through the appointments at Chelsea the second time and at Manchester United, where the sound bites are always very, very similar. Jose's there. He's the happy one, as we found out the second time at Chelsea. He says that he's full of happiness taking this job now. You look back to 2016 when he got the Manchester United job. Ed Woodward said, despite all evidence to the contrary, Jose is quite simply the best manager in the game today. That was on the announcement. I think nobody agreed with him then. Ed Woodward won't agree with that now either. So there's this allure around Jose Mourinho that seems to attract him to people in power. And I think that might be at the crux of it here. For Daniel Levy, is it just a bit of a status statement to say, under my tenure as owner of this club, I have taken us to this level where we can get a guy who at one stage was the greatest in the game? With the talk and, you know, the constant talk about a possible sale of Spurs as well, just in terms of elevating their position within Europe, elevating their position as a club, to be associated with a guy who, despite on the pitch, the game seemingly passing him by, is still so box office within world football. I think that has to be the key to this. That has to be the crux of why he's so attractive to him. Whether it's Levy's ego himself to say, I brought Jose Mourinho to Tottenham, or if it's just to elevate their standing in football.
Philip, who will Jose like and not like in this team? David Shepherd says, will Son do his military service just to escape?
I think Son is probably one of the players he would love the most, I would say. Never injured, always enthusiastic, team man and so forth. I'm trying to think of the players that Harry Kane as well, obviously. I'm trying to think of the players whom we might have some problems with. I think Eric Lamela would be one. I think Dele Alli very much so. Danny Rose.
Why Dele Alli?
In terms of character, personality, unless he can unlock the old Dele Alli in the young Dele Alli, if I can say so. I mean, you can see problems. I mean, of course, and there's the Ericsson situation, because, you know, it's not just that he hasn't got any money, apparently, to reinforce the squad. It's that Christian Eriksen could be on his way in January. Can I also give you a quote? Patrick Collins,
the wise
man from the Mail on Sunday, former Mail on Sunday, for me, one of the best of the best. And he says, Daniel Levy sacks a gifted visionary and replaces him with a cynical poser. Mourinho has always been the manager of choice for gullible, starstruck chairman. It will end in tears, of course, but Mourinho will leave with his pockets full, as he always does.
Contract till 2023. I mean, it's crazy. Given his record of how he approaches jobs in the second or third season, just seems incredibly naive from someone who doesn't like to spend his money too liberally.
Well, is Tottenham's, or the insatiable desire for Tottenham fans for their team to win anything, is that worth it for them to have him in charge? I don't understand that. I'm not sure. If I'm watching a team that plays good football, and admittedly they haven't been playing particularly good football in recent months, I'm not that fussed if they win stuff or any, you know.
I think there is a real divide about how, you know, what the point of football is and why you go and watch it. And I don't think, and maybe because I'm a Cambridge fan who also likes Tottenham, I don't think trophies are central to this, because if I did, I would have stopped watching football, right?
Well, in football and in you know, Gaelic games, hurling, which would be my sort of sport of choice, I follow teams that don't win anything. They just don't win. So I'm... My expectations, trophies don't really enter into it at all.
But Tottenham don't really win either, really, yeah. Do they?
But when they do, because of that reason, it will be fairly phenomenal, yeah. for the fans of the club. I was at the game that really started turning it for Mauricio Pochettino this season at home to Newcastle, when they were beaten 1-0, went behind in fairly early on in the game, and barely registered a chance all game. And it just lacked that cutting edge that the good Spurs teams the last couple of years have had. They were completely clueless of how to basically break down the low block of Newcastle. And it seemed to me in that game, the general atmosphere around the ground, Pochettino's substitutions making very little impact at all, something wasn't right, and it was only going to end fairly shortly in him leaving the club.
The game they lost against Brighton, I think, was... if you put the 7-2 against Bayern Munich, it's a bit of an aberration. The defeat against Brighton, it was like, that was grim. Mm.
On Daniel Levy, I mean, his appointments. So what, Hoddle was there in 2001, then Santini, Yol, Clive Allen as caretaker, Juan de Ramos, Harry Redknapp, Villas-Boas, Sherwood, Pochettino, Jose. Is Pochettino the only... There's an argument that Harry Redknapp was good there, right? Whether you think he's a tactical genius or not, Tottenham got to the Champions League. They had a fun side with Van der Vaart and Modric, etc. You know, it was a fun time. But actually, how many brilliant appointments has Daniel Levy made?
The brilliant one is Pochettino.
Yeah.
The only brilliant one, Harry Redknapp, was not exactly unknown on the scene. And that's Pochettino, really.
Regardless of what this is for Daniel Levy... What is this for Jose Mourinho? This?
Well, for the first time in his career, he's moving to a club where he has absolutely no hope of winning a title. He's moving to a club which has got very little financial means. And if you compare to the pathway of his career, you know, Porto, the springboard, Chelsea, the millions of Abramovich, and you carry on Inter, you know, also a great squad, aging, but great squad, Real Madrid being Real Madrid. And then you realise there aren't that many players. I mean, Manchester United being Manchester United, and also loads of money to spend there. And for the first time, he's in a position where he's taking a job which is a little bit beneath himself, really, in terms of his career and of his trophy haul and so forth. I mean, you have to remember the clubs that he was approached by, before he took on the Tottenham job. Are definitely not in the super elite. He was approached by Guangzhou Evergrande with the possibility of also taking on the Chinese national team at the same time for an absolutely phenomenal salary, which was around 35 million, something like that a year. He was approached by Celtic. He was approached by Benfica. He was approached by Lyon, who certainly wouldn't haven't offered him such extraordinary wages. There was a contact with Inter, but Inter went for Antonio Conte. And you carry on like that, and you think, well, actually, no, he wasn't that much in demand. And it is a first in his career. At the age of 56, he's had to downgrade from the Premier League, so to speak, of super elite clubs to the Championship.
Obviously, the big winners are Amazon and David Squires. So that is Tottenham done. They go to West Ham. It's the early kickoff on Saturday. A lot of people will be watching that, won't they? And that'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Wales. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Next Wednesday, Barry, the last chance to see you in 2019, isn't it? Unless you're, you know, in Gujarat or Kerala. before your gap year, we are at the Indigo at the O2. Me, you, Jonathan Wilson, Ellis James, and there are a few tickets remaining, and we would love to fill it.
Yes, Jose Mourinho, whatever we say about him, he is box office. He will not be there, but we will almost certainly mention him in passing.
Mm. And I've had a good idea that I'm going to film with Philippe Auclair, which will involve a lot of swearing, which may make it onto a massive screen at the O2, if you're in for it, Philippe.
I'm game.
Excellent news. So yes, please come next Wednesday. If you've got nothing else on, we'll put lots of links on Twitter and pester you. And frankly, you owe us, so come.
That's a fair point.
The 20th of December, we're pretty much sold out at the Belgrave Music Hall in Leeds. We love you, Leeds. Me, Lars Wilson, and one more. And the January 27th is sold out, but 28th, Still a few tickets left at Liberty Hall in Dublin. Me, Barry, and two more. And it is the Football Supporters Association Awards. Please vote for Guardian Football Weekly for Podcast of the Year. David Squires is nominated. Susie Rack is nominated as well. The Guardian overall is nominated. And if you want to, David Conn is also nominated. So you have to choose Conn or Rack. It's up to you. And if you want to vote for any radio shows that me and Barry do, you are also welcome to do that. Wales are in the Euros, everybody. Two goals for Aaron Ramsey. The first after great work from Gareth Bale. The second, he latched onto a Kiefer Moore's touch. In between that, Wayne Hennessy made one brilliant save. But, Barry, it seemed pretty straightforward for Wales, this, I thought.
Yeah, and I think we were expecting it to be quite straightforward, given that Jonathan Wilson said Hungary weren't very good. Wales have some terrific players. I was worried for them that maybe Ryan Giggs wasn't the man to take charge of nurturing this talented group. But he's got away with it. I don't know how much credit he deserves for it, but they're through to the finals, and they got to the semi-finals at last Euros, and I can't see any reason why they shouldn't do well again.
Aaron Ramsey is such a wonderful player, Philippe. Do you think we kind of took him for granted at Arsenal? I feel I did.
I don't think so. I think he's one of those players who every time we thought he had reached his level, he got injured. And that was that's the story of his career at Arsenal, that he had one wonderful season. I can't actually remember which one, but in which he scored over 10 goals, double figures. And you always thought, oh, this is going to be good. And at this point, he gets injured. And also the fact that he never really commanded a starting place in the lineup. Mm. He never made it quite his own. So yes, there was some frustration. He's also a player who could disappear in games from time to time. But I don't think, taken for granted, no, I don't think so. It's just that it's a career that has a little taste of it could have been better, if you see what I mean. But the reasons why it could have been better are not necessarily, they're not down to his talent or his professionalism or anything like that, but bad luck, I'm afraid.
There's still time.
There is still time, but you wonder, you know, the club, where he is at the moment, he's not getting the opportunities maybe he would have elsewhere. And that's a bit of a problem.
George, some people have noticed Gareth Bale during this game and afterwards, with a marvellous F-bomb post-match, and frankly, just being so ludicrously living for the now and not thinking about the consequences, I would say. The Wales Golf Madrid flag, that obviously he didn't make, but he danced behind it.
You don't know.
Oh, I don't
know. Maybe that's what he does, and all the time he's got in Madrid.
Embroidery.
Yeah.
If possible. Wales Golf Embroidery Madrid. I mean, we found it funny over here. In Spain, they have not found it particularly funny.
Yeah, I won't try and read out the Spanish headlines and butcher the language, but quite amusing to go through the papers for the last couple of days and see how the Spanish press have taken it, because it's fair to say they haven't seen the funny side. And no surprise, really, at all. I mean, Gareth Bale hasn't treated Real Madrid with much respect for the last 2 years, but I'm sure he feels like he hasn't been treated with much respect by their fans either. So it seems fairly obvious, especially so long as Zinedine Zidane is their manager, that his time in Madrid is probably coming towards an end. Maybe the managerial appointment we spoke about in part one may have an impact on that sometime in the next couple of months. But, you know, he's a fantastic player. And personally, I think that it's often forgotten. I mean, even earlier you spoke about the Harry Redknapp Spurs team, and Bale wasn't even given a mention. It's sometimes easy to forget what an impact he had in the Premier League. And whilst he may not be the same player now he was 6 or 7 years ago, I'd still absolutely love to see him back over here. On the Ryan Giggs point, though, it's maybe says a bit about their campaign that they've got Aaron Ramsey, they've got Gareth Bale, even Daniel James now starting for them. And in a group which wasn't the strongest, alongside Croatia, Slovakia, Hungary and Azerbaijan, they only mustered 10 goals in 8 appearances in 8 games. That doesn't bode particularly well for the Euros. I think you're right in saying that they've probably got away with having Giggs as manager rather than him masterminding them towards the major competition. But nonetheless, brilliant for their fans and the players.
I always thought the same about Chris Coleman, but the Wales players appear to love him. I don't know if they have the same warmth for Giggsy, but I do think that group of players has achieved the success they have in spite of their manager rather than because of the managers
but
they've had.
They look like they love it. And I suppose that's easy to say when you've just qualified. There have been games I've seen where they didn't necessarily love
it. Well, I mean, they all always turn up. You know, you'd imagine if Gareth Bale had gone to China in summer as looked to be on the cards at one point, he'd still be, you know, make it over for every Wales game. Players turn up.
It's funny to say that when Ryan Giggs is the manager.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Players turn up when they're injured just because they enjoy the crack. And I think the Republic of Ireland used to have a similar feel good vibe. You know, I've heard Tony Cascarino say on numerous occasions he absolutely could not wait to go and play for Ireland, mainly because it was a week-long piss-up, but...
whatever works,
whatever
right?
works, yeah.
Talking of Real Madrid, according to Diario Sports, the squad are, quote, breathing again with the news that Jose Mourinho is now off the market.
Especially Sergio Ramos, I can tell you that.
Clinton says, can anyone confirm if Ellis James has come down from his cloud yet? Well, let's ask him. Ellis, have you come down from your cloud yet?
No. And do you know what? I feel very, very spiritual. I think something really changed on Tuesday night. I was telling Barry this last week. I'd started doing the Headspace app, the meditation app. No need anymore. I've deleted it. I'm fine. I'm cured.
You didn't look too chipper yesterday morning, Ellis. Photographic evidence on social media suggested maybe you were a little bit hungover.
Yeah, and but you've got to celebrate these things, haven't you? And I was talking to you about how we'd done sleep training, and I thought my son was going to sleep through the night. Well, I was on my own last night with him, and he woke up four times. And even though I was hugely hungover, I'd go over to his cot. I would just whisper into his face, you are living in a golden age. This is a golden age. He doesn't seem to care, but I do. What a day. What a week. What a result. What a country. What a life.
I love how much you love this.
Because it's just... I mean, I could... you know, try for a long time to justify international football. But one of the things I love about it is that you've got Gareth Bale and Aaron Ramsey next to Lincoln City's Joe Morel. And you know, Chris Gunter is an absolute hero for Welsh football fans. He's got 96 caps. He's not even 30. And also, he's always been really good for Wales. But you have to play players like that alongside, you know, players who are world class in some cases. And I quite like that mix and match attitude. And also, the group I go with, we've got lads from North Wales and West Wales and Cardiff, support different clubs. And I just like seeing us all being represented on the pitch. So I'm quite... I find the whole thing quite moving. Sorry. I know that a lot of people don't have much truck with international football, but I absolutely love it.
And, you know, Wales's record in sort of must-win games is not great, is it?
It's horrific. It's awful. So we needed to beat Scotland in 77, Scotland in 85, Romania in 93, Russia in 2003, the Republic of Ireland in 2017. I read somewhere that I think we've been within one game of qualifying, I think it's 11 times since 1958. But what was strange about Tuesday, and the reason I feel that this cloud has lifted, is that 58, obviously before my time, but that was an odd one because Turkey, I think, refused to play Israel. FIFA said, well, they can't just qualify without playing anyone. So we hadn't qualified. We were drawn out of a hat and we played them in a playoff. For 2016, we lost to Bosnia, but then results elsewhere went our way and then we qualified. And then, you know, the final game, it was just a celebration. But we didn't have that just sense of release that we got on Tuesday. And also with our record in those must-win matches, Nuremberg 91, Yugoslavia 76, we always lose. We always have an important player missing. Mark Hughes against Romania, Rambo against Portugal in the semi-final, John Charles against Brazil in 58. We're always missing someone. But we had Alan back and Ramsey and Bale, who were all match fit. Alan obviously back from suspension. And over the last 7 years or so, when those three players play together, we tend to get good results. So they're so important for us. But this is a golden age because, you know, qualify for two tournaments in 4 years proves that 2016 wasn't a flash in the pan. And also coming so close to qualifying for 2018. I mean, I was brought up in an era when we were losing to Holland 7-1 in Eindhoven. And, you know, the Dutch manager saying, oh, Wales tested us for the first 5 minutes or so and Neville Southall was our man of the match. The man who conceded 7 goals was the man of the match. So,
what are your hopes and expectations for the tournament? You know, will Kiefer Moore be your Hal Robson Kanu?
Well, you know, I mean, this is the ridiculous thing. It wasn't really working under Giggs, and he was playing this false nine, and he was tinkering a lot, and he was never really playing the same 11. It appeared that he didn't know his best first 11, and then suddenly Kiefer Moore appears. Apparently, it took ages for him to find his passport. Yeah. His grandfather's from Llanrig in North Wales. I think he was born in Torquay, and then. But because he's massive, like he is absolutely massive, he's now this focal point and he holds the ball up and he brings Dan James and Ramsey and Bale into play and he's an out. And so suddenly now it looks like Ryan Giggs, I wouldn't say stumbled because that implies that it's an accident, but he's discovered a formula that works. And, you know, in June, when we lost back-to-back qualifiers against Croatia and Hungary, it looked like it wasn't going to happen. So, you know, I'm absolutely delighted. I mean, I'm really, really delighted. I've thought about nothing else for 48 hours.
So, Ellis, with Kiefer Moore as well, what I love about his story is that when, back in 2016, in that summer, he was looking for a new club, having been released from Norwegian side Viking, and ended up signing for Forest Green Rovers in that summer. So when all the carnage was going on in France, Kiefer Moore was looking for a club, and now he's leading the line, taking you into 2020.
Yeah, and, you know, Ethan Ampadu, who's a really important player for us, I think he was 15 in Euro 2016. I mean, he hadn't even done his GCSE. That's really crazy. And who'd have thought that, you know, 6 months ago, that Kiefer Moore and, you know, he made his debut in September, I think Kiefer Moore and Joe Morel would be so important for us. But Joe Morel, again, is another one. His job is he breaks a play and he wins the ball back and then he passes it to someone who's better than him. And he was fantastic against Azerbaijan and he was great against Hungary. But special mention for Aaron Ramsey, who was just majestic on Tuesday. And as a country, we've overproduced strikers for the last 60 or 70 years. Trevor Ford, John Charles, Ivor Orchard, Toshack, Rush, Bellamy, Hughes, Saunders, Hartson. We've always had a striker, but we've underproduced attacking midfielders and playmakers, and he would walk into any greatest ever Welsh 11 and Ramsey playing like that. And you know, I think he's going to improve at Juventus. That's the exciting thing. As long as we can keep him fit, then it's very exciting.
Yeah, key. Ellis, listen, lovely to speak to you. I'll see you at the O2 next Wednesday.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm just going to sort of float to the O2. I'm just going to... I might not say anything. I just sit there and smile.
Just giddily lying on a beanbag. It'll be a pleasure to have you, whether you say anything or not, Ellis.
Thank you very much. Anyway, see you next week.
Yeah, Ellis James there. Wales correspondent, I would suggest, for Guardian Football Weekly. To the Republic, Barry. You're not floating. Are you floating or are you sinking?
I'm sinking into it.
A Danish
quicksands of Danish despair.
So you drew 1-1 with Denmark.
Oh, of course we did.
Yeah. Matt Doherty's late goal, cancelling out Martin Braithwaite's opener, but not enough.
No, not enough. I was hopeful, but not particularly optimistic before the game. Ireland actually played reasonably well, but I think a lot of that was down to the fact that Denmark let them have plenty of the ball, and Denmark were kind of happy enough to sit back, soak up pressure and try not to concede and catch one on the break. And ultimately, we just same old story. We don't have any firepower up front, and our inability to score cost us. The game could have gone either way. A draw was, once again, probably a fair enough result. And into the playoffs we go, where we will face Slovakia.
Sean says, would Barry have bitten your hand off for a playoff semi-final in Bratislava if you'd offered it to him last year?
No, because I expected more of us in a group that we should have got out of. And but, yeah, a playoff in Bratislava is what we've got, and that's hopefully... I mean, it could be teed up as a playoff final between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, which would be quite big news across the Irish Sea. And there is a lot of enmity between some supporters of both sides. I have no beef with Northern Ireland team at all. I'd like to see them do well.
That comes from you can play for either regardless of where you're born. Isn't that the sort of... That's amongst other reasons for
Well, there's... The whole religious thing is the main thing. But I think Northern Ireland get quite cross with the Republic for poaching their players in the past. But that would be a huge game if it comes to pass.
It's lucky you didn't bite my hand off, because the game is not in Bratislava. It's in Trnava.
Okay.
You say Northern Ireland, they could... play you. They lost 6-1 to Germany. Michael Smith gave them a lead with a banger of a strike. That's where the fun ended for them. Serge Gnabry with a hat trick.
Magnificent hat trick by Gnabry.
He's a player, isn't he?
Wonderful. And I have to say that this Germany team is getting better and better by the game. Gnabry, but also... I'm sorry to say that. The goals were the highest quality. Goretzka is really starting to impress everybody. Toni Kroos is almost back to his best, certainly with the national team. Julian Brandt is also confirming all that we think, which is good about him, which is, in my case, an awful lot. And they will have to be watched very, very closely.
Yeah, but have they seen how good England are?
Barry, stop it. Scotland's winning streak continues. They were 1-0 down to Kazakhstan, but they won 3-1. Two goals for John McGinn. A couple of other things of note. Italy beat Armenia 9-1 with seven different scorers. And Belgium beat Cyprus 6-1. Christian Benteke scored two. Could be a hot shout for top goal scorer at Euro 2020, Baz.
I'm telling you, yeah. Actually, just what you were saying about all those different scorers for Italy, I think... Ireland, the goal Matt Doherty scored for Ireland was their 17th goal by 17 different players in a row.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
16th.
Who was the last
17th.
Person to score two goals for Ireland? Who was it? Niall Quinn?
Probably Robbie Keane.
Probably. Now, Spain have relieved Roberto Moreno of his position. He'd initially stepped in to replace Luis Enrique. As Enrique had stepped back from management to look after his daughter, who sadly passed away. The plan was that Moreno would be sort of warming the bench for Enrique, but at some point it seems that he'd been promised the job behind the scenes. He left the 5-0 win over Romania without doing the post-match, apparently absolutely distraught. And seems like they are very close friends, Enrique and Moreno, but seems like there is no place for Moreno now in the managerial setup of Spain.
Sid wrote a very good article about that, in which it's difficult to know, basically saying something happened between them, but no one knows what. Not sure if their friendship has ended. I mean, obviously it's a story with its roots in real tragedy, but nobody seems quite sure whose fault it is that this mess has occurred, Marina or... the Spanish FA, and given their track record, you'd have to say it's probably the head of the Spanish FA that's made a pig's ear of everything.
Now, concentrate, please, everybody. The playoffs. The draw for Euro 2020 playoffs takes place tomorrow, Friday. 16 teams will be in the draw, which is split into four paths, A, B, C, and D. Each path will contain four teams. Those teams will be ranked based on their performance in the Nations League. They will be divided into two single-leg semi-finals, the best-ranked team playing at home against the worst-ranked team, and the team ranked second playing at home against the team ranked third. Even though we already know who Ireland and Northern Ireland are playing. Anyway, the winner of each semi-final would contest a final. The draw will decide which semi-final winner plays at home, which could well be a significant factor. The winner of each of the four playoff finals will book their spot at Euro 2020, joining the 20 teams who qualified the usual way through Euro 2020 qualifying, to make a total of 24 teams at the major tournament. Is everybody with me? Is anybody with me?
How many people have we just lost on the
podcast? Is anybody still listening? Please tweet if you're still listening to the pod. Now, after that, we have the draw for the Euros, right? And normally, it's quite fun, isn't it? The draw, who'll be in the group of death, etc. That is on the 30th of November, next Saturday evening. Prime time, going up against Take Me Out. It would be easier if Paddy McGuinness hosted this, just added it on to Take Me Out somehow. Right, so the seeding is worked out by performance in the qualifiers, so we know who the seeds are. Some of the teams have already been assigned their groups because the 12 host nations are guaranteed to play home games. And each group is being played between two stadiums and countries. So, for example, Group B already has Belgium, Russia and Denmark in it.
England's Group D.
Yes. Yeah.
England play three games at Wembley, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And I have tickets to go to Hampden Park for one of those games. And if Scotland get through, that might mean that I have to watch England Scotland at Wembley in a pub in Glasgow, which could be fairly hairy, which I'm a bit concerned about.
But could also be fun.
Could be quite fun.
Yeah. You sound and look quite English, George, I'm going to say.
I thought you were going to say Scottish then. No. I don't think I could go undercover as a Scotsman.
No. But I mean, you don't have to paint a St. George's cross on your face, I guess. So in the playoffs, Path B and Path D are decided, right? Path B is Bosnia and Herzegovina versus Northern Ireland, Slovakia Republic. Path D is Georgia, Belarus and North Macedonia v Kosovo. Iceland are in Path A and Scotland, Norway and Serbia are in Path C, with a draw to decide who joins who and where. So when they do the draw next Saturday, in the group will be TBC, as in from the playoffs. I know Kevin De Bruyne has said it's ridiculous, Philly,
yeah,
doesn't it?
I've got his quotes here. I think I love what Kevin De Bruyne said. He said, translating from the French, "It's a shame, honestly, for me. Football is no longer football. It's more and more like a business. It completely skews the competition. We lose all the pleasure of a genuine draw." I think he's spoken for us all.
This will be Manchester City's Kevin De Bruyne talking about competition being skewed,
yes,
and how unfair it is. Okay,
that it was more and more like a business.
Thanks, Kevin.
Still, you know.
No, he has a point. I'll give him on that one. I'm not sure he's thought his quote true.
Anyway, I think the best thing to do is just wait and see and just get your wall chart, and then you'll know
exactly
who's in what group. In fact, don't even watch the tournament. Just find out who's won at the end. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll do George Ellick's Football League Hour / 15 minutes / however long you want to do. Look ahead to the Premier League football at the weekend and a couple of other things too. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Just to look at the Premier League games this weekend. Obviously, all eyes will be on West Ham Spurs at 12:30. Did you see West Ham had sort of tweeted a video going, yeah, see you on Saturday, Jose, with some clips of West Ham beating Jose Mourinho sides?
And they've since removed it, I believe.
Oh, is that so?
Because there is no place for humour in this world of serious football world of ours.
That'll come back and bite you.
Well, it probably will. But that game, they've really sort of stolen Manchester City and Chelsea's thunder, haven't they, Tottenham?
Mm. City play Chelsea. That's the late game on Saturday, which is exciting to see how that goes, Philippe.
Very much so.
What do you think?
What do I think? I mean, I'm always not that keen to do any prognosis, especially for games which follow an international break. You're never quite sure who is going to be fit, who is going to be tired, who is not going to be available. Strangely enough, I have this feeling that Chelsea is going to do something that people are maybe not expecting them to do.
Ooh.
Lose?
No. No, come back with a point or three. That's just a gut feeling, but I've got absolutely nothing to base it on apart from the fact you may well be right.
Yeah. Hmm?
Those two games aside, match of the day doesn't look fascinating. Bournemouth Wolves, Arsenal Southampton, Brighton Leicester, Palace Liverpool, Salah Robertson out for Liverpool, Everton Norwich and Watford Burnley. Am I doing those fixtures a disservice?
Maybe. I think they are quite... I would say Arsenal-Southampton, given the state of play at the Emirates at the moment, is a big one. For Southampton, obviously. But for Unai Emery, given the state of his relationship with the fans and the fact that these fans are waiting for the board to do something, I would imagine that if it goes pear-shaped, as it has in the previous weeks, the pressure is going to become very, very, very hard on Emery. Mm. So, yeah, and it's quite a big game. The Brighton game as well I'm interested in.
Because you think Brighton have got a sniff against Leicester?
I do, as well. Absolutely.
Interesting.
No, I think we are underselling that.
Okay, fine. Well, you never know, do you? That's the beauty of the game, right?
Could be a classic. Especially, as I said, after an international break, you always have surprises in those games. Always.
Sunday, the one game on Sunday, Sheffield United against Manchester United. Sheffield United took down Pochettino. His last game was that 1-1 draw. That Spurs were sort of lucky to get a point from that.
They might get him a new job now.
Sunday, return the favour. Let's do the Football League Times with George Ellick. Where do we want to start? Preston North End, second in the Championship, the biggest scorers. I had not predicted that, George. Had you?
Not for them to be the top scorers. I think they're a club that everyone who follows the EFL admires a great deal, and they maybe don't get the credit they deserve because year on year they seem to overachieve compared to their budget. You know, they're not one of these Championship teams who can buy former Premier League players or really even go across to Europe for their recruitment. They seem to look down into League One, into League Two, and take the best of the crop. And Alex Neil, as the manager, who's obviously been around for a long time, he took Norwich up to the Premier League what seems like a long time ago, but he's actually still very young. He's only 38 years old, and he is doing a fantastic job at Preston. He was very strongly linked to the West Brom job last season and got a new contract there. On the back of it, he then was approached by Stoke, seemingly illegally, a couple of weeks ago before that was brushed under the carpet. And he deserves immense credit because they are a team who play football the right way, attacking style. As you say, the top scorers in the league, boosted slightly by a penalty record this season that will not continue for the rest of it.
Is Graham Alexander still putting them away?
No, he's not. Oh. It's now Daniel Johnson, who is the unlikely scorer of 8 goals this season, who's never, I think, got to double figures before in a season and is sitting pretty on 8, including 5 penalties. But with Preston, it's going to be difficult for them to maintain this level of form, but it doesn't look like a particularly strong Premier Championship this season. West Brom are at the top of the table, who look like a decent bet under Slaven Bilic to stick around there. Matias Pereira, a player who they brought in the summer, is one of those guys who's come and played at completely the wrong level. I mean, there's no way he should be playing in the Championship. He's a cut above. And then, of course, Leeds, who we'll get on to. But except for that, no real standout team so far. And if Preston can maintain this level of form, if they can continue picking up the points under Alex Neil, I think this will be one of those managerial achievements up there alongside the likes of Chris Wilder last season, which is truly not generational, but we don't see every season. And he is a guy who has done very well to rebuild his reputation after being sacked from Norwich and is destined for very, very big things.
Let's get on to Leeds. Obviously, Bielsa means that we're all still excited about them. They've conceded the fewest goals in the Football League, just 9 in 16. Are they exciting?
They are very exciting. And there might be people who look at the table this season and think that maybe they haven't built upon last season. But the story of their season so far is basically Patrick Bamford being unable to put the ball in the back of the net. They are consistently still dominating games. They are consistently still playing this fluid brand of football that basically doesn't allow the opposition to get anywhere near their goal. So it's easy to concede the fewest goals when you are so in control of the game throughout. Their ability to win the ball back whenever they lose it is quite something. They lost Pontus Janssen in the summer to Brentford, and people wondered how they were going to replace him. They brought in Ben White on loan from Brighton, a player who we didn't know much about, and he has been a Rolls Royce at the back, a brilliant passing centre-back. It's incredible to think that he has had so little first-team action so far because he looks like a Premier League defender at the moment. And if they can find a way to get Bamford back scoring, and of course he's been a prolific scorer at this level before, so there's no reason why he shouldn't. They're still the favourites to win the league in my book, and I think they are with the bookmakers as well. And I think it's a matter of time, unless things go terribly wrong, surely this is the season where we see them finally get back to the Premier League, because they are still the dominant force in the league.
At the bottom of the Championship, Barnsley appointed their new manager yesterday, Gerhard Struber, signing from Alo Alo, swapping Europa League football for Oakwell.
And a move that, yeah, has raised eyebrows. Of course, he was manager of Wolfsburger in Austria. He only took over in the summer as well. He'd done his coaching apprenticeship, we should say, at the at Salzburg and amongst the Red Bull conglomerate of clubs. So he's got that pedigree behind him. But he moved on to go to Wolfsburger in the summer to try and further his own coaching career, and has made a big impact there with some really good results in the Europa League, including a home draw against Roma a few weeks ago as well. So people wondering why he's made the move. I think it's hard to it's easy for us to forget just how big an allure English football is and how big the Championship is as well. And it gives him a platform, I guess, to prove himself at a slightly higher level. But he's got his work cut out because Barnsley at the moment, bottom of the league and really struggling.
So one place below them, Wickham, top of League One. They're doing very well, aren't they?
Yeah, no one saw this coming. Anyone who tells you they did is telling fibs.
You predicted it, Barry, didn't you? I remember you saying early on your big prediction.
Yeah, I said to Marcus Bean, now that you've left, I predict great things for Wickham, and so it has come to pass.
An extraordinary job from Gareth Ainsworth, who was linked to the Sunderland job a few weeks ago. They ended up going to Phil Parkinson, but maybe that job will be coming up again quite soon, given how it's been going there so far. Adebayo Akinfenwa at the centre of everything that Wickham are doing again this season. He may not play 90 minutes consistently, but he's scoring goals and making himself a nuisance. They've only lost one game out of 17 so far on 36 points. They are currently 7 points clear of third. This is a team who were well tipped for relegation this season. And, Ainsworth took over the club when they're in League Two and not fancied in League Two. So if he can take them to the Championship, that really would be something. A fan-owned club as well, who've had some really difficult times financially, under new ownership from an American businessman coming through at the moment. So fingers crossed for brighter times ahead for Wickham on and off the pitch.
You mentioned Sunderland. A question from a Barry Glendenning on Twitter. Why are Sunderland so diabolically bad?
It's hard to say. I was someone who thought that Jack Ross was doing a pretty terrible job throughout his tenure. A lot of stats about how few games he lost, but generally Sunderland were diabolical to watch. And I would say we're fairly lucky to get within one game of a return to the Championship last season. But since he's left, it has got even worse. I think for Phil Parkinson, the run of games probably looked quite attractive when he took over two leasings.com games, an FA Cup game against fairly poor opposition, and a Carabao Cup last 16 tie. They're now out of all three competitions. He managed to lose both of the leasings.com games despite playing pretty much a full strength team. And for Phil Parkinson now, I think they've got four home games of their next five in the league. So it's going to be pretty important for him to start getting some results here, or I think he'll probably be out of the job by Christmas.
At the bottom of League One, Bolton have finally made their way above zero. Three wins on the bounce for them. Any signs of survival?
Well, the only issue is they've got to 1 point, but there's still a possibility they're going to be further docked points due to being unable to put out a team for a game earlier this season. So they're on one at the moment. It could be back to minus numbers quite soon. But the job that Keith Hill's done since he went in there has just been phenomenal. They were so bad, naturally, because they were playing mainly a youth team at the beginning of the season. So you can't blame them for that. And he's brought in some experienced pros. But even with the players they brought in, I mean, Darryl Murphy is, of course, the headline signing, who just a couple of years ago was top scorer in the Championship. But they shouldn't probably be as good as they are at the moment. And he's built a real spirit there. And even if this season does end in relegation for Bolton, you do get the feeling that under new ownership, with Keith Hill at the helm, they are in a better place, even if that place is League Two.
Curious story from Oxford, your team. Seventh in League One, but only Liverpool have a longer unbeaten run in English football.
Yeah, I was warned that we're going to have to talk about Swindon later on, so I thought we'd talk about Oxford as well for a little bit. But Carl Robinson is doing a fantastic job there. And with a team including Ben Woodburn, who probably would have been involved in that Wales squad had he not been injured, Cameron Branigan, who was at Liverpool previously, was even linked to the likes of Real Madrid and Barcelona at one stage. He's built a team of young and hungry players, and it'll be interesting to see if Oxford can keep hold of those star men in January, because you've even got Shandon Baptiste, who turned down a call-up from Granada a couple of weeks ago because he says he still wants to play for England whilst he's a 21-year-old centre midfielder playing in League One. So exciting times to be an Oxford fan.
And all change in League Two.
Yeah, all change in League Two. Again, it's all very, very congested at the top end of the table. Swindon, as I mentioned, seem to be the class team in the league at the moment with a very promising manager called Richie Wellens. And Owen Doyle, I think, is already on 16 goals for the season, which is pretty good going. And Forest Green below them and Cheltenham as well. So good news for the West Country with Exeter also in fifth. So a congested top end of the table. Swindon on 33 points, then all the way down to Plymouth, who are in 11th place on 26. So it looks like it's going to be a really exciting battle for those playoff places.
News from Stevenage. Their caretaker manager, Mark Sampson, has been charged by the FA for making an offensive remark. Former England women's head coach is alleged to have made the remark to a coach who used to work with the side earlier in the season. It was alleged the remark was aimed at a player during a conversation about transfer targets. A statement from the FA released on Wednesday read, Mark Sampson has been charged with a breach of FA Rule E3. It's alleged a comment made by the Stevenage FC caretaker manager breached FA Rule E3-1 as it was improper and or abusive and or insulting. It is further alleged that the comment also constitutes an aggravated breach, which is defined in FA Rule E3-2 as it referenced ethnic origin and or colour and or race and or nationality.
Yeah, a tricky one this for Stevenage, because when the allegations were first levelled at Mark Sampson a couple of months ago, they were fairly quick to say that he had done nothing wrong and that they were happy with the evidence that they were shown that there was nothing in the allegations whatsoever. So for a couple of months later, for it to come out that the FA are charging him with this is not very good for them, especially given Mark Sampson's previous with the England women's team. Important to note that he, you know, there was a settlement in the end about his unfair dismissal after there was a clearing of sorts of his name. But for Stevenage now, it's going to be difficult for them. I mean, how do they broach this, given that they were so quick to stand by their man, but the FA have obviously seen enough evidence to suggest that there was some wrongdoing?
We don't have time in your Football League section to discuss the glorious Colin Calderwood revolution that has Cambridge in mid-table in League Two. Long may we stay there. But thank you, George. In the FA Cup, Eastleigh are into the second round. They beat Stourbridge 3-0. Salford are out, losing 4-1 at Burton. Bromley lost 1-0 to Bristol Rovers in their replay. In the 76th minute, they had an equaliser disallowed because it came straight from a throw-in. It is definitely worth watching. I'll tweet it out. Basically, the guy does a long throw and every single player on the pitch tries to touch it, but misses it. And it goes in the back of the net and everyone looks quite confused. A couple of questions to finish with. Dan says, with Harry Redknapp suggesting that Arsenal fans would have been happy with Saddam Hussein in charge if they were winning matches. Have you seen this? Could he have done it on a wet Wednesday night in Stoke? And which world leaders, dead or alive, would make the transition to the dugout? He was suggesting, perhaps not entirely unfairly, that football fans don't necessarily mind who is in charge of their club if they're winning games.
So are you saying that...
And he went full Saddam.
Yes to Saddam, no to Jose Mourinho. There are limits, you know.
Honestly. What do you reckon? Could Thatcher have done a job at Charlton?
I don't think she'd be a popular appointment at either of the big Merseyside
No,
clubs.
I think you're probably right.
Mahatma Gandhi, I would...
Forest Green Rovers for Gandhi. Why not, eh? Alex says, you have Alan Shearer and Harry Kane as your strikers. One can only score headers, the other only penalties. How do you split it?
Kane for the headers and Shearer for the penalties.
I agree.
Well, do you?
Oh, God.
That is difficult.
I just toss a coin, really.
How good was Shearer at headers? Because he was next to
decent, but
Ferdinand, who was really good. And
Sheringham was the best.
Sheringham was very good at headers as well, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. So, and Sutton, too.
Well, that's because of the yard of space he had in his head.
Of course.
All right, that'll do. Barry, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, George.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Philly.
Thank you.
We shall be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.